First of all, let me say welcome to the Minneapolis Fed. I see this workshop as being one more step on an important intellectual journey for the Federal Reserve Bank of Minneapolis. And that journey has been going on for many years, long before I became president of the bank in 2009. As most of you know, Ron Feldman and my predecessor Gary Stern literally wrote the book on Too Big to Fail nearly 10 years ago. Like many others, and for the good of the country, I hope that our Too Big to Fail journey is complete before another decade passes. And the work that all of you are doing is critical to making that hope a reality. I should say, although I don't think I have it written down here, that I'm going to be speaking on behalf of myself, and the opinions I express today are not necessarily those of anyone else in the Federal Reserve System. Another point, we're going to have questions and answers after I'm done speaking. Unlike the rest of the conference, this portion of the proceedings is open to the media, and so you should keep that in mind when you formulate your questions. I will be keeping it in mind when I formulate my answers. So my theme tonight is that metrics should play a key role in the regulation and management of the too-big-to-fail problem. I'll be using TBTF, which an acronym will be familiar to everyone in this room. I will proceed in three steps. I'll first define what I see as the TBTF problem. As you will hear, I see the TBTF problem as being about a particular kind of misallocation of resources. More specifically, excessively risky investments that are incented by the prospect of governmental absorption of losses that would otherwise be endured by the creditors of financial institutions. So that's a mouthful, but the key word in there is prospect. So it's the expectation of government transfers that create the problematic distortion, not the realization of those transfers. So I'll next turn to why I see metrics as being essential to the management of the too-big-to-fail problem. Without metrics, policymakers and the public that they serve can have no true insight into the effectiveness of the current management of the problem. Now, as this group well knows, and we've been spending our time talking about, any given measure of the size of the too-big-to-fail problem is imperfect. But I will argue that the imperfection of any single measure implies that policymakers should track progress using many measures, not ignore all of them. Finally, I'll talk about two aspects of the use of metrics in the management of the too-big-to-fail problem. Why it's important to use measures besides size, and why it may be important to assess the robustness of too-big-to-fail measures to certain kinds of shocks. Let me start then by defining what I mean by the too-big-to-fail problem. As I mentioned already, I'm going to use this term to refer to a type of inefficiency in the allocation of societal resources. In particular, I'm referring to the excessively risky investments that are incented when creditors of a financial institution believe that there is some likelihood that at least some of their losses will be absorbed by the government. I know that the nature of this inefficiency is familiar to everybody in this room, but let me talk through it more carefully. Imagine first that creditors did not anticipate any form of governmental loss absorption. Then, if a financial institution decided to increase the risk level of its investment portfolio, its debt holders would face a greater risk of loss. By way of compensation, for that greater risk, those debt holders would demand a higher yield on their debt holdings. As a result, in the absence of government guarantees, financial institutions would find it more costly to obtain debt financing for highly risky investments relative to less risky ones. This effect, on the margin, would curb a firm's appetite for risk. But now suppose instead that a financial institution's creditors believe that they are partially insulated from losses. Then those creditors do not demand a sufficiently high yield when they lend to riskier institutions. Financial institutions end up taking on too much risk because they're no longer deterred from doing so by the high cost of debt finance. Now, there are two particular aspects of this definition that I think are worth noting. First, it's an ex ante definition. I'm not referring to the ex post manifestation of governmental loss absorption in the form of transfers or bailouts. In my formulation of the too big to fail problem, the damage to society through the misallocation of resources has already occurred by the time that the government actually makes its transfers or undertakes any bailouts. Now, to be clear, like many other observers, I do find it troubling when governments use funds from relatively poor taxpayers to protect relatively rich bank bondholders from losses. Now, I'm not using the term too big to fail problem to refer to concerns about this kind of redistribution. Second, the definition emphasizes the role of creditor beliefs about prospective governmental transfers. The beliefs of other parties are much less relevant. For example, to the management or board of directors of a given financial institution, the too big to fail problem simply means that their costs of debt finance are relatively unaffected by the amount of risk in their firm's investment portfolio. You know, what the source of that lack of variation does not really concern them. So that's the first part I wanted to lay out, is exactly what I mean by the too big to fail problem. And as I've defined it, the too big to fail problem involves a misallocation of resources. So let me move on to my next point, which is the need to use metrics in the management of the problem. Now, as we all know, at the direction of legislators, bank regulators and bank supervisors have taken a variety of steps to reduce or end the misallocation associated with the too big to fail problem. As a result, the public knows that large financial institutions have more and better capital than they did 5 years ago. And the public also knows that these institutions have constructed lengthy plans, so-called living wills, that describe their strategies for rapid and orderly resolution in the event of material financial distress or failure. What the public does not know is whether the adoption of these steps has been associated with material change in the size of the too big to fail problem. And my theme tonight is that policymakers can only identify and document progress in the reduction of the too big to fail problem by using measures of the magnitude of the problem. Now, the good news is I think that it is clear what we want to measure. The heart of the too big to fail problem is that some financial institutions are able to borrow too cheaply in light of the risks they face in their investment portfolios. What we need to measure then is the size of that subsidy to debt finance. Now, of course, as this group well knows, the conceptual formulation of the problem only gets us so far. Actually constructing reliable measures of the subsidy has a number of challenges, and that's why we're having this workshop and why it's important. And admittedly, at this point in time, and probably for some time to come, every measure of the magnitude of the problem has to be seen as imperfect. And some might be tempted to conclude from these imperfections that it would be inappropriate to track progress with respect to too big to fail using any of the measures. I cannot emphasize how wrong I believe this conclusion to be. Rather than using no measures, policymakers should be tracking all measures that are viewed as being at least somewhat informative about the size of the subsidy. Now, here I find an analogy for the monetary policy part of my job to be helpful. So I serve on the Federal Open Market Committee, and the FOMC is charged by Congress with two objectives: promoting price stability and maximum employment. There are relatively uncontroversial metrics that we can use to track progress on the former objective in terms of price stability. But it is not as obvious how we should track progress with respect to the latter objective, the maximum employment mandate. Every possible metric, be it the unemployment rate or the employment population ratio, has its own flaws. But the response of the FOMC is partly to abandon metrics altogether. Instead, monetary policymakers track labor market performance using a large number of measures. For example, in a speech earlier this month, the president of the St. Louis Federal Reserve, James Bullard, depicted recent labor market performance and recent labor market improvement using a variety of dimensions, along a variety of dimensions, using an elegant spider chart. I can well see similar charts as being useful in providing the public with assessments of the size of the too big to fail problem for a given financial institution. So I've talked about how I'm defining the too big to fail problem, and then talked about the need to use metrics to track the management of that problem. Let me close by offering two comments about too big to fail metrics. And the first comment, again, I think is more aimed at people outside of this room than the people inside the room. Some observers are drawn to using the size of a financial institution as a sufficient statistic for the magnitude of the too big to fail problem associated with that institution. After all, it's called the too big to fail problem. And actually, if you saw our banners for the conference, we sort of fed into this with the huge too big and then the little too fail part here. This kind of approach of focusing on size would suggest that society can best manage the too big to fail problem by capping the size of financial institutions, make sure they don't get too large. Now, I certainly agree with these observers that the size of a financial institution is likely to be a useful source of information about the magnitude of that institution's too big to fail problem. But at the same time, though, policymakers should guard against relying too much on this single metric. We should always keep in mind that the term too big to fail is highly misleading. The too big to fail problem is about creditor perceptions of loss protection. Creditors might well see the smaller of two institutions as being more likely to receive that protection. If the smaller institution is engaged in some kind of activity that is seen by government agencies as being especially vital. This goes back to the conversation we had earlier today about what exactly are institutions, what kind of activities are they engaged in, and which ones are going to be seen as being particularly vital by the government. So if we go back to 2008, government funds were used to facilitate the purchase of Bear Stearns by J.P. Morgan Chase. No such government funds were made available to facilitate the resolution of Lehman. And Lehman was certainly larger than Bear Stearns. The second comment is about the need to assess the robustness of too big to fail measures to particular kinds of shocks. I define the too big to fail problem in terms of the subsidy to debt finance created by the possibility of governmental loss absorption. Now, certainly, policymakers can only claim success with respect to the too big to fail problem if the current measures of that subsidy are low. But they may want to accomplish more than that. The too big to fail subsidy to a financial institution is generated by its creditors' perceptions of government loss absorption. Now, the subsidy will be worth little if creditors believe that the institution's assets have little risk. So it's highly unlikely that the institution will ever incur losses for the government to absorb. It may be prudent for supervisors and regulators to also check that the subsidy remains small if creditors begin to perceive that the institution's asset risk is actually materially large. I see these kinds of robustness checks as being challenging to implement with existing too big to fail measures. I'm going to wrap up by returning to my main theme, which is the need to use metrics in the management of the too big to fail problem, however imperfect those metrics might be. Basically, the issue comes down to accountability. And again, I find a monetary policy analogy to be helpful. As monetary policymakers, my colleagues on the FOMC and I are accountable for keeping the economy at maximum employment. We are well aware that we need to use metrics to demonstrate that we're making progress with respect to that responsibility. No one metric is perfect, And so we refer to a wide variety of somewhat informative measures. And the Federal Reserve actually spends a great deal of time trying to develop other, again, imperfect measures to supplement those that we already have. I see the too-big-to-fail problem as highly similar. Supervisors and regulators have been made accountable by Congress for ending the too-big-to-fail problem. They need to be able to demonstrate clear progress to the public with respect to that responsibility. They can only do so by using the metrics in this workshop and metrics that will be developed in workshops still to come. Thanks to all of you for listening, and thanks for coming to Minneapolis. And I look forward to taking your questions.
So if we think about too big to fail as a misallocation of resources, and we think about wanting to have metrics, what metric can you envision that would capture misallocation of resources? I'm thinking about building houses out in the desert that shouldn't have been built. I mean, how would you ex ante pick out what the misallocation of resources is?
Yeah, I think, so my vision is, I think, well aligned with what we're seeing in this workshop, which is really picking up on the measures of the subsidy as being a, so that means that people are able to borrow more cheaply as a result of that subsidy. And so just keeping track of that, if that subsidy goes to zero, then we don't have a misallocation of resources anymore being caused by that subsidy. So tracking the subsidy, I think, helps a lot in that dimension. It would be useful. I'm sympathetic to the thrust of your question, which is, there'd be nice to have ways to take that price measure and map it into quantities in some way as well. But I think that is not the first line of attack that I'm worried about. I think just tracking the price measure alone is going to be very helpful and very useful for us.
So I think the use of measures can be very valuable, but I have heard discussions about the use of a too-big-to-fail measure in trying to assess a capital charge. In essence, if you want to compare it to your labor market example, it would be like using labor market measures for a minimum wage calculation. So what do you see as the ideal use of such measures? Would it be in monitoring reports? Where are those measures going to be ideally used?
Yeah, that's a good question. I mean, FOMC, of course, is sure you know. I mean, we use the unemployment metric to determine something about the stance of monetary policy. So if unemployment is, outlook for unemployment is too high, then that tells us something about how to adjust the stance of monetary policy so as to make better improvement, more progress towards our objectives. I see these metrics can be used in the same way, if they remain persistently high, I think that should be telling us something about whether or not we have sufficient capital charges being held against those institutions. It may tell us something about the nature of the resolution planning. So I don't, there's going to be different ways to, I'm not going to be telling you exactly how to exploit it, but that's also true with monetary policy. We have many tools and we can exploit a lot of them to try to make better progress. But if these metrics are staying high, that's telling you something about the insufficiency of your ability to deal with the problem. And that means you have to do something about that. And I think others have talked about there's sort of an ex-ante way to deal with this issue, which is levying more capital, and the ex-post way, which is to try to improve the credibility of the resolution planning. And I would see, if these metrics remained high, then you'd have to be pulling one of those two levers to try to improve things.
What do you think we need to be doing that we're not to get to the point you're talking about?
So the only point I'm talking about right now is that I think that when we talk about how we're doing on the too big to fail problem, say, as the Federal Reserve System, we should be reporting more fulsomely about trying to track that progress more quantitatively than we're doing. I think right now there is a tendency to be talking about the inputs into the problem, which is we've done this, we've done that, and we've done these other things. So that's more on we've improved the resolution planning. We have more capital in place. That's all true. But then the question is what does that translate into in terms of the actual subsidy itself? And I think the way to do that is not to rely on any one measure as being perfect, but rather to be relying on a host of measures and figure out the right way to, you know, that's an important problem, but there's a right way to do that using appropriate graphics and tabular reporting as a way to ready to communicate.
Thank you. Over the last 5 years, the central bank in the US and other central banks internationally have massively increased the quantity of support, liquidity support, to their banking systems and the terms, and ease the terms on which that liquidity support is offered. Do you think that that constitutes any sort of implicit subsidy? And if so, do you foresee that subsidy remaining in steady state as we emerge from the crisis?
So that's a good question. It's a good question. When I say that, it means I haven't really thought as deeply about it as it deserves. So. When I talk about this, I'm tracking more whether we're seeing a subsidy that's coming from loss protection. So whether or not people who are lending to the bank perceive that they're somehow being advantaged by the perception of prospective loss protection. Liquidity support, I mean, you know, the Federal Reserve is famous for never having lost a penny on any of its liquidity operations in terms of what we do with the discount window. That's because we take a lot of protections to make sure that happens. So I don't see those as really being the same as loss absorption. So I guess I wouldn't follow you into thinking about those as being the same kind of support that I'm talking about. That answer is worth about as much as the time I talked through it, because I haven't thought more deeply about it than that.
Does it take
a couple more, yeah. Okay.
As I think Ron could probably tell you better than I, supervisors view bad loans as being made during good times, when presumably all of these measures would be showing relatively low subsidies. So how do we go about unwinding that bias in the measures, or should we be looking at other ways to do it?
So that's a great question. That's what I was trying to talk about at the end when I talked about robustness. I mean, so when these measures are low, there's two reasons why they could be low. It could be because people perceive the risks to the economy, essentially, as being low. Or it could be because they perceive the risk of loss as being low, given that those risks, those macroeconomic shocks or the bad loans actually turn out to be bad. Right now, the measures we have do not separate effectively between those two components. I think it would be useful to have that. I think it's going to be very challenging, I will say up front. But I will say the following. If the ex-ante measure remains high, I think that's a sign that we have a problem. You're pointing to the fact that even if it gets low, we might still have a problem. I'm sympathetic to that. But you don't want to give up on looking at measures altogether just because when they're low, that tells you that we might still have a problem. I'm sympathetic to that point of view.
The flip side for too big to fail would be too small to save, right? And the element of, do you think that there's the negative connotation of too big to fail helps that investors are actually better off investing in these type of institutions if explicitly or implicitly they're going to receive some subsidy, or because we're going to have somewhat of a negative view of institutions that get defined as too big to fail, that you're going to see maybe some of a return to perhaps a smaller or more local banking model?
You know, I mean, it's to try to highlight one of the other messages I was trying to deliver. It's more too complicated to fail or too vital to fail is more the terminology. Will we end up getting to a banking system which has more of a disconnection, shall we say, between the vital functions that banks are doing and government protection? That we might see happen. I mean, that's almost the point of making those activities costly. That is, to try to ending that, if you have government protection that's wedded to a particular vital functions that a financial institution are doing, that gives an incentive to keep those vital functions within the boundaries of the bank. If you remove that subsidy, then there's that you have much less of an incentive to keep that within those boundaries. Well, you know, in terms of tracking the ultimate destination of the banking system in terms of distribution and concentration, you know, I think there's lots of forces at work on that. I think this is probably only one of many kinds of forces, technology, other kinds of regulatory pressures. I don't think this is really going to be telling us a lot on that dimension, where we're going to end up in terms of the size distribution of firms in the banking sector. What I think it might tell us about, as I said, is the kind of activities that we see our banks doing, what's glued together, might change because there's less of a subsidy to put the put the vital function within the inside an entity that's receiving finance and proceed to have that government support. Yep. Thank you very much. Appreciate it.